Mr. Volzer.
Good morning. Harvey Volzer. I represent the appellant, Michael Davis. We're here today concerning a ruling that was made in the U.S. District Court that there was no subject matter jurisdiction in this case, proven by the plaintiff. And since a court, rules through its orders, and since in this particular case there's absolutely nothing that tells you why the decision was made other than the fact the decision was made.
The reconsideration, you mean?
The reconsideration and the initial order, Your Honor, just says lack of...
The hearing transcript.
We have the hearing transcript, and I'm basing my argument today on that and the fact that it appears that Judge Motz decided that there was no proof of any contact between Mr. Davis, the relator, and federal government investigators prior.
But let's step back a moment.
Yes, sir.
Except with respect to the denial of the motion for reconsideration, review is completely de novo, right?
Yes, sir.
So it doesn't matter what he said. The question is what the record establishes.
I would agree.
Okay. So let's not worry about Judge Motz.
Okay. Well, we'd argue this, Your Honor, that the record does contain evidence of contact by Mr. Davis with HHS and the FBI OIG, and that the information is on page 14 and page 19 of the personal statement, disclosure statement, dated March 11th, 2006, by Mr. Davis.
Sorry, are we in a particular place of the joint of the appendix?
Yes, sir. In the sealed appendix, page 14, okay. And then again on page 19. And this personal disclosure statement was part of the record in the case. It's docket entry 2 and 3. It was filed at the same time as the complaint. And it clearly shows the context, and it also shows the basis for knowledge that Mr. Davis had in detail. And also, in the motion to reconsider were attached letters in the 2004-2005 timeframe to both the HHS Office of Inspector General and the Department of Justice, which again goes through all the fraud allegations and the fact
that is where there is deference owed to Judge Motz.
Right? I'm sorry, sir?
That is the issue on which there is deference owed to Judge Motz. Right, and we could reverse only for abuse of discretion, and the documents don't seem to be newly discovered at all.
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, there were, just to give a little context, and this is also in our brief, the attached as Exhibit 2 to the final brief, rebuttal brief, is a decision by Judge Bates in the companion case, which was filed 2 weeks after this particular case was filed. And that, if you look on page 7 of that exhibit, which is near the end of the appellant's rebuttal brief, final brief, it talks about the letters to the Justice Department and the Department of Human Services. And if you compare those with that was before the court in a similar case, and a decision was based that these constituted the prior notice by Mr. Davis.
Yeah, but just to go back a minute, the proposition that these documents were timely provided in one case does not mean that they were timely provided in the other case, right?
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that There was, in this particular case, they had the same Attorney General representative in both cases who knew.
This isn't a question. Oh, okay. So you're saying this goes to timing, not, because that's what Judge Williams is asking you about, right? Timing.
Yes.
Okay. Timing of the event in court is what the denial of the motion to reconsider is based on.
Right. But at that time, the appellee knew that these letters existed, knew that they predated the filing of both cases, knew that they had even been copied on it.
But the defendant relies, in part at least, on Findlay, which and the Findlay problem would exist regardless of this particular set of facts. So, I guess it's sort of strange, I think, to say, well, we didn't have to produce the evidence before the judge in a timely way because our adversary was familiar with this evidence.
Your Honor, we would argue...
It's a remarkable switch of duties.
Well, we would argue that it was timely, even if it was produced as part of the motion for reconsideration. If you look, and that's part of the record...
But you aren't saying it qualified as newly discovered evidence.
On the contrary.
Well, it always...
It's old hat.
Right, we're saying it is old hat, and it was known to the other side. They weren't confused. They had it in the prior case, and they had it for 9 months before we had the teleconference call with Judge Motz.
You didn't, in your brief, as I recall, argue that Findlay should be revisited.
No, we didn't.
In the light of Rockwell.
No, sir, we didn't. But, so what we're arguing is, you know, there's apps. If Judge Motz had looked at the personal disclosure statement, which was in the file, was presented to the court, was noted in the original pleading that was filed by Mr.
I'm sorry, which disclosure statement?
The personal disclosure statement that's in the file for Mr. Davis.
First 500 pages first, or something.
Well, yes, but particularly the first 15 pages.
In the seal.
In the appendix I have, the complaint is pages 1 to 22.
It's in the sealed.
This is the sealed portion here.
Yeah.
Judge Williams.
So you're saying that if Judge Motz had thoroughly studied pages 1 through 525
he would have known
what exactly?
He would have known about the prior contacts with government investigators. In the first 15 pages.
Contacts
between
satisfying Findlay?
Yes.
But you aren't saying that at any point you brought this to his attention?
I did.
Until the motion for reconsideration.
No. Before that, mentioned that the personal, that this would be in the docket entries that were under seal, which were 2 through 6.
And that's this was exactly filed with the complaint, correct?
Yes, sir.
But under seal?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So because it was under seal, the other side didn't have access to it.
Correct.
But you're saying it showed the judge, because it has some correspondence from earlier years, would show the judge that you had made a complete showing to the department.
What we're saying is the first 15 pages of the sealed appendix would establish that, and especially the part that's called contacts with government investigators, which is on page 14.
And you're saying that those would show that Davis satisfied Findlay's requirements.
Has it been unsealed?
I'm sorry, sir.
Is this unsealed?
No, sir.
All right. Here, why don't you take this paragraph that he's talking about?
That's why I'm using such a page.
Okay. So you're saying that, carefully read, this would show that Davis satisfied the Findlay requirements.
Yes, sir.
It's that brief paragraph on the middle of 14. I've marked it in the margin.
And that is exactly what was relied upon by Judge Bates in the companion case. He did read it, and you know, the personal disclosure statement, which he says, and also the letters.
That concerned a different fraud, didn't it?
It's the same parties.
It's fraud allegation, I mean.
Right. There's different attorneys on the case. You know.
Doesn't that other case involve the public schools?
Yes, it did.
And this involves the public health system.
Yes, sir. But if you look at the letters to the HHS, Office of Inspector General, and also to DOJ, they're both mentioned as the subjects. And they were investigated at the same time by HHS and by the Department of Justice.
Just looking at what Judge Bates says here, letters demonstrate the plaintiff not only filed a statutorily required disclosure statement with the government before filing suit, he also provided the government with the essential elements or information on which the QTAM allegations are based. Now, that does not seem to address the Findlay timing problem.
Well, Your Honor, if the suit is filed in this case, March 15, 2006, and all the prior documents to the investigators for the government are dated 2004, 2005, then it's well before the filing of the complaint.
But Findlay says before public disclosure
of the
information, and which is different than before the filing of the complaint.
Well, and we are arguing that the public disclosure occurred at the time of the 2006 filing of the complaint. That before that, and we tried to bring this out, the only two public disclosures that are brought up by the appellee are the 2000 GAO report, which, if you read it, has nothing to do with the allegations in this particular case or in the complaint. It has to do with an Anti-Deficiency Act problem and the use of congressional funds by a D.C. government, and it's for a period from fiscal year 97 to fiscal year 2000, so it even predates the allegations here. It's a completely different situation. The other one is a 2003 contract case, which is cited in a footnote in the opposition, in the motion to dismiss filed by the appellee in this particular case, and it says the gravamen of that case is breach of contract. Mr. Davis did work. He was never compensated for it. Once again, it has nothing to do with the fraud, has nothing to do with any of the allegations in the complaint. So we argue that that's prior to any public disclosure.
This paragraph at 14 recounts two instances in which you were contacted.
Which paragraph you're in?
13. I'm looking at no. It's 14 of the of the sealed supplement.
Yes, sir. I'm there.
Page 14, which is page 13 of the document.
Yes, sir.
And it says it's three sentences. The first and third paragraph, first and third sentences recount that you were contacted by someone in the government, not that you wrote letters or disclosed information to the government.
Well, Your Honor.
Davis and Associates was contacted, and then we were contacted.
Well, Your Honor, there's me that was inarticulately drafted, but you know, we do have the letters making the initial contact.
And what would have put the district judge on notice of that?
I'm sorry?
How would the district judge have known that?
Oh, from reading this? Well, Your Honor, taken in context of the whole document, we would say that that's, you know, I think it would be very clear from reading that that all the contacts came from Davis and Associates, not from the other way. Plus, how,
I don't know.
There's no indication.
Not the way it says it. I mean, you could have been, there could have, as far as this is concerned, there could have been a self-initiated investigation at the department in the course of which, because of your work as a contractor, you were contacted.
Well, Your Honor, this has to be read, of course, in conjunction with the complaint. And the complaint clearly says that, all the aspects concerning the fraud were the product of the independent knowledge of Mr. Davis. So it doesn't logically follow that, or is there any evidence that anyone other than Davis and Associates contacted the government? And also, the point I tried to make at the very end of the final brief, rebuttal brief, was that the Department of Justice was supposed to be part of the teleconference call. And they did call in and were disconnected and were never made part of the contact again. If they had called, they would have established that all the, that he was an original source, Mr. Davis, and that he had contacted them and HHS OIG.
Did you object to going forward without the department on the phone?
Well, Your Honor, just, in retrospect, I should have. But, read the transcript. It was us. We're not going to wait. And I believe that's.
Well, that's exactly the circumstance where counsel's objection is critical, right? Then you have, at least under some conditions, reversible error.
But, Your Honor, in this case, remember that Department of Justice was never contacted by the court, pursuant to Judge Roberts' order or at any time concerning the dismissal. They were made part of the...
At least as far as one could tell, it appears that they were copied in on the various papers going back and forth.
Copied on everything,
right.
But the Judge Roberts' order said that they had to be contacted prior to any dismissal and that they had to give written consent. And that's Exhibit 1 of the rebuttal brief as part of the record in the case itself.
I'm sorry, it's Exhibit 1 where?
In the... Appellant's rebuttal brief, final brief.
Did you have a conversation with the clerk's office about this filing?
I'm sorry, sir?
Did you have a conversation with the clerk's office about this filing? I have not in 25 years seen such a document. That is, say, a composite opening brief and rebuttal brief.
I did, in fact, talk to someone in the clerk's office.
You did?
Yes, sir.
And they said fine?
Yes, sir.
Have you ever heard of a case called Carducci versus Reagan?
No.
It draws a vital distinction between arguments raised in the opening brief and ones raised in the reply brief. For which, apart from sort of clarity of reading, the sequence, opening brief, answering brief, reply brief, has legal consequences.
In that the reply brief is limited to replying to things raised in the, it can be repetitious, of course, often is, but it's not an occasion for introducing a new argument.
Well, Your Honor, I know nothing more. As a matter of fact, the last case I was here was Congressman Lucan's case in which you were on the three-person panel, and that would be 96 or 97. It's been a while since I've been here. So I apologize, and I was calling your clerk's office and making a pest out of myself quite a bit because I didn't know any better. But I did get, I did what I was told.
All right, well, you've
just looking at this thing on. Oh, I see.
Paragraph six
of that order.
Yes, sir.
Should the relator or defendant propose to be dismissed? court will solicit the written consent. I guess that if the statute did not require the written consent, it's hard to see that that paragraph would make that the law.
Well, it is the law in the case at that point, because it is a prior order in the same case by the court. And
well, it's an order that the court will solicit. I mean, I guess, you know, promises that a court will do something are can be are not necessarily law.
Well, Your Honor, it is, you know, it was set down there for a reason by Judge Roberts, and it wasn't followed in this case.
It was said, but you did not call Judge Mott's attention to it.
To this?
Right.
No, once again, it was part of the file.
Further questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Velzer. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stacey Anderson on behalf of the district. Since the court just finished up with talking about the Department of Justice participation in this, I'd just like to offer a couple comments on that. First of all, with respect to the petition participation by telephone in the hearing with Judge Mott, there was no objection to their absence. Moreover, that occurred before the court issued its initial decision, and their non-participation was not a subject of the motion for reconsideration either. With respect to whether or not the Department of Justice had to be consulted with before the case was dismissed, it's my understanding that's a fairly common request, but it goes to voluntary dismissals by the quitam relator. The department wants an opportunity, if the relator elects to voluntarily dismiss their case, to come in and pick up the case.
That's what statute seems to require.
Correct, Your Honor. In cases of dismissals for subject matter jurisdiction, that does not require consent of the Department of Justice. Judge Brown, I would like to pick up on one of your points, which is, I think, key to this case, and that's the question of when the public disclosures occurred here. Now, it's the district's position that the public disclosures with respect to the allegations of fraud all occurred no later than June 8, 2004. And I want to start by defining what the allegation of fraud here is. The allegation of fraud is that the district sought Medicaid reimbursements from the federal government and failed to pay those monies to DC General Hospital, who was the Medicaid provider. That's the heart of the allegation of fraud. And that information, district's not conceding that's true, but information regarding that allegation was in the public domain no later than June 8th, 2004. And that information came in through two primary sources. First was the
What form is the June 8th?
The June 8th
publication.
No, actually, Your Honor, I'm using that as the demarcation. It's the oral argument in the this Superior Court case, or the DC Court of Appeals case, where the district, during our oral argument in that case, conceded on the record that in fact we had sought Medicaid reimbursements, that those Medicaid reimbursements were not paid to DC General Hospital, and they in fact went in to the General Revenue Fund. So that information was in the public domain well before this lawsuit was filed. I'm at a disadvantage here with respect to the content of the personal disclosure statement because I haven't seen it. I don't know what it says. I would just ask the court keep in mind a couple of facts. One, I don't understand why this information could not have been made public. The subject matter jurisdiction was an issue in the case. It's the plaintiff's burden to prove that, in fact, the district court had subject matter jurisdiction. Many of the letters he references were made public, so it's unclear why the information contained in this could not have been made public. Second of all, the public disclosure statement was not brought to the district court's attention until the motion for reconsideration. And again, the standard there is an abuse of discretion. This was not newly discovered evidence. The plaintiff was given two opportunities in this case to specifically address the issue of whether or not he had disclosed this information to the district, the first being the opportunity to respond to Judge Mott's specific request for briefing on that issue.
Well, I want to get to that in a moment, but back up just a second. Is the oral argument transcript in the record?
From the district of, no, it's not, Your Honor. It's not. If I'm not mistaken.
Is it public record?
Yes, Your Honor, it is a public record. An oral argument in front of the D.C. Court of Appeals would be public record.
Is it difficult to obtain and submit the relevant portion?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I think it would be wise, or at least useful, if you would do so. copy, counsel, of course.
Again, that was not, that, I just want to point out also, Your Honor, that was not a contested fact below, that in fact that had occurred. But I will be happy to provide the court with the oral argument.
That the concession had occurred?
Correct. Yeah. That the district had made those representations during their argument. That was not disputed.
Now,
it's certainly disputed that there was no disclosure until a later date.
I think, well, yes, that is disputed, Your Honor.
So this would be helpful in that respect.
Certainly, Your Honor.
But if we gave Mr. Volzer's interpretation of the document you haven't seen, if we accepted that, then that preceded June 04, because it talks about early 04, which I suppose is before June.
Again, Your Honor, I would go back then to highlight the additional disclosures that occurred in the case. The General Accounting Office disclosure in 2000, referencing the fact that the district was not keeping its Medicaid reimbursement funds any separate fund for the benefit of D.C. General Hospital, but it, in fact, commingled that with the General Revenue Fund.
Related to earlier years than are involved in the current allegation.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The years involved in this allegation are fiscal years 1994 through 1999. I believe that 2000 report, there was certainly some overlap with those years in the GAO report.
I think Mr. Volzer said that was 94 to 97.
The GAO report?
Right.
Right, but what I'm saying
I'm sorry, 97 to 2000.
97. Right, and ours is 94 to 99, so you've got a two-year, 97 to 99 overlap. So I would again suggest that was a disclosure related to this case. In addition to that, there were the Superior Court filings in 2002 or 3. Where, again, Mr. Davis was brought suit against the District of Columbia, again, alleging that there had been, that he had discovered these Medicaid reimbursements and so on. And then his brief in the Court of Appeals, which is part of the record. It was submitted as an exhibit by the district.
All right. Now, Judge Motz, in the order requesting supplemental briefing, perhaps you can remind me where that is.
It's a letter, Your Honor, and
I think I've got it here. Public Appendix at 99?
Correct, Your Honor.
Says, it's not clear whether the first sentence of the middle paragraph, it's not clear whether plaintiff ever provided to the federal government, quote, written disclosure of substantially all material evidence and information plaintiff possesses. That is a quotation or track, it's a direct quotation from 3730B2, correct?
I don't dispute that, Your Honor. I'm not sure how it compares to the language.
3730B2 requires serving the government with the personal disclosure statement.
Correct.
It's actually what it requires is that along with the complaint, substantially all the evidence.
Yes.
And there's nothing about timing in that provision.
Correct, Your Honor.
So the plaintiff then shows that he's met the requirement of B2 by showing service on the department of that document.
Correct, Your Honor.
So you seem to be arguing that the judge was requiring a filing consistent with E4B, the original source requirement.
Correct, Your Honor.
But that's not what the judge was quoting.
You're correct, Your Honor. I do see that now. Yes.
So do you have any spur-of-the-moment argument as to what was wrong with the submission that was made? Not on reconsideration, but in response to the request?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Do you have a spur-of-the-moment response to that? Independent of Judge Motz's letter requesting that, plaintiff had the affirmative burden of producing that evidence in response to the district's motion to dismiss and failed to do so. So if you take Judge Motz's letter simply asking for the B2 disclosures, he complied with that. But before Judge Motz ruled, he never provided those letters to the court, and he was on notice that the government was challenging the subject matter jurisdiction of the court based on a lack of disclosure. So even though, I mean...
Let me make sure I understand this. So you're saying that the service of this, the 500-pager, I think that's what this is, right?
Again, I haven't seen it, Your Honor. I have no idea.
Well, of the personal disclosure statement, do you know that that's what it's called?
I know that, yes.
Okay. That has appended to it various exhibits, including correspondence from 2004, I believe. So, I mean, if Judge Motz erred as a matter of law here, if he did, that would be an abuse of discretion, wouldn't it? I mean, I think our cases are pretty clear on that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would have to concede.
So if the filing really was adequate response to the B2 request, dismissal was a mistake.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know. I mean,
again, because basic requirements.
He complied with the B2 requirement.
The plaintiff had to meet.
Right, exactly, Your Honor. Again, not having seen that, the district, I can't respond to that, Your Honor, frankly. And again,
whether it's actually substantively adequate, I understand.
Yes, correct, Your Honor, yes. I think, again, but again, I guess the response still is that the district should have had an opportunity and he should have produced the information so that we could have responded to that. And I go back again to our position earlier, which in fact the public disclosures, even if you assume an early 2004 contact with the government, there were sufficient information in the public domain by that point that the government would have been well aware of.
And I may be mistaken, I'll find out from Mr. Bolzer, I may be mistaken about those letters being in there in the first place. So. We'll find out in a moment.
Okay. I mean, again, he only references the public disclosure statement itself. I don't know that what among the other 500 pages goes to the issue or not.
Let me ask you this. It looks pretty clear from Rockwell that Findley is not entirely correct.
Okay.
And that since we're dealing with a jurisdictional requirement, I think we need to satisfy ourselves on that. It's clear also that Mr. Bolzer hasn't raised that point. But am I correct that we nonetheless need to be satisfied as to our jurisdiction or lack thereof?
Oh, absolutely. If the court believes that Rockwell alters the analysis, then certainly the court's bound by the Supreme Court precedent. In my mind, but I don't think Rockwell alters the outcome here. I think the application still on this facts is the same. The result's the same under Rockwell.
Because of the earlier documents you referred to.
Absolutely,
yeah,
yes.
I take your argument.
Absolutely.
And that's particularly the GAO report.
The GAO report, and again, also his suit in the Superior Court and then the subsequent appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Now, Mr. Bolzer, I think have something to say about the GAO report. And I'm not sure what your
answer to that was. Recall correctly, he said it simply didn't deal with the allegations of fraud here. And I think he's looking at the issue too narrowly. It doesn't have to deal with the allegations of fraud here. The question is whether or not the information necessary for the federal government to assess whether fraud had occurred was in the public domain. And the crux of his fraud complaint here, Your Honor, is that the district was commingling Medicaid reimbursement funds with its general revenue rather than putting them in the dedicated fund for payment to DC General Hospital.
And that's when he says that report involves an investigation of an alleged violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act, you're saying regardless of what the legal theory was, the facts were there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. It's a question of whether the facts underlying the fraud claim are in the public domain.
So then he says it nowhere mentions False Claims Act, fraud, Medicaid, even HHS, false submissions to HHS, preparation of fraudulent documents. Now, if all that's correct, are the facts there for the government to connect the dots?
Yeah, I believe they are. Again, they are, Your Honor.
Is the GAO report in front of us?
It is an exhibit, yes, Your
Honor. That's not sealed, right?
No, sir. And it was submitted, and I can actually
have. All right, could you point me to something in the GAO report along these lines?
I did. I believe I quoted it in my brief.
You probably did. This is the third case of the day, and I'm not sure.
No, it's okay, Your Honor, and I'm not sure I can put my finger on it as quickly as I can.
I'm not sure where we are.
I've cited, it's on page 12 and 13 in my brief, and particularly page 13, and I cited the unsealed appendix at pages 68 and 69. And I've been corrected. Apparently, it's on page 66 of the joint appendix.
I see.
Oh, that's the beginning of the report. I cited.
All right, so then 68, turning to 68. Could you give us a fact or point us to something on 68?
Yes, Your Honor. and again, also on page 13 of my brief, if I can find this sentence. It begins, the district's submission indicates that it centrally manages its cash by pulling together available monies from its various operating and capital project funds. Mm-hmm. The Public Benefit Corporation participates in the district's cash management pool. The district uses its pooled cash when making payments on behalf of the Public Benefit Corporation. Again, that's the corporation that oversees DC General Hospital, to its employees, vendors, service providers, contractors, and others. When the PBC overspends or overdraws its share of the pooled cash, it has a liability to the district's general fund, which essentially loans the cash to PBC. The cash is advanced for cash flow purposes with the expectation that it will be repaid when the Public Benefit Corporation converts accounts receivable to cash. And in this case, the accounts receivable at issue are the Medicaid reimbursements that the district was due and owing. So from this paragraph, what you can gather is that the Public Benefit Service Corporation or the Public Benefits Corporation did not keep a separate pool of funds as required by appellant contends the statute. And in fact, pooled its money with the general revenue of the district. And when it received those Medicaid reimbursements, they didn't go directly to DC General Hospital. They went into the general pool where they were spent on all manner of things because all the money was there. So those, again, those are that information is at the heart of the allegations here. With respect to this, the false form that's also been alleged here, there is no indication in the record that the plaintiff in this case has any direct or independent knowledge of the district ever having falsified a form. That is based on speculation and conjecture. There's no evidence in the record to support it, no allegation in the complaint establishing that the plaintiff has any direct or independent knowledge of that alleged fact.
Perhaps that comes in around the back door of something that I wanted to ask you, because the documents that you've been pointing out go to whether there was a prior public disclosure.
Correct.
But that wouldn't preclude his suit if he's an original source.
Exactly, Your Honor. Again, well, no, it would. Yes, it would. If he was an original source, it doesn't matter if he was an original source if the information is already in the public domain. Again, the purpose of the Queen's...
Well, under Rockwell, the timing matters, right?
The timing, yes, the timing matters. I mean, certainly, the timing matters.
So the statement you made may be untrue depending on the timing.
If you accept the district's position that there was a public disclosure, it's impossible for him to be an original source in 2006 when he filed his suit, because all the information was in the public domain. The original source is a two-pronged test, whether you have direct and independent knowledge and whether you gave that information that you have to the government before you filed your suit. And that timing issue turns on whether or not there's been a public disclosure. And here it's the district.
I think you're relying on Findlay.
No, yeah. That's Findlay. Because Rockwell would say as long as you did it before you filed, right? And here I think the pre-filing part of it, he might actually have complied with.
I'm going to have to look at Rockwell again, Your Honor. Again, it was not an issue that was briefed by appellant, but to me that doesn't make sense given the underlying purpose of the False Claims Act statute, which is to encourage people to provide their information to the government early on so that the government can intercede and stop the fraud and recover the most possible money for the government. So to say that this information has been floating in the public domain for 4 or 5 years, and as long as he pulls that information from the public domain and runs to the government before he files a suit and tells the government about what's already out there, that he's an original source and satisfies that requirement. I just, that doesn't make sense to me, and I'll have to look at Rockwell again. And if your honors would like supplemental briefing on Rockwell, I'm happy to provide that.
Well, we may ask for that in the fullness of time. And you might look also at Judge Henry Kennedy's exegesis of Rockwell, pointing out really that there is no perfect solution, and the Supreme Court's reading in Rockwell does have the fault you describe, but that's its reading.
Your Honor, so like I said, then I'd like an opportunity for supplemental briefing on that issue if I could have it. And I, again, would ask
I think we can rely on our asking for it if we're about to rule on that basis.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Or even considering whether to rule.
And I will make an effort to get the transcript of the D.C. Court of Appeals argument to Your Honors.
And to counsel, of course.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Bolger, I'll take 2 minutes.
Just briefly. You know, the GAO report speaks for itself, and it starts on page 65 and goes through several pages, but you can't make it more than what it is. And it says anti-deficiency act
violation. It describes behavior of the district.
Correct. And that's it, that the over... And it
well,
says,
but if the behavior is the same as your client's complaint, I don't see the label makes a difference.
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, wouldn't that be a question of fact for the trier of fact?
No.
I don't see it. I don't see it.
This is the question of whether the court has jurisdiction of a QTOM claim.
But it doesn't appear that the court made its determination based on that argument.
Yes, but I think the question is what's in the record. I mean, if it's a factually disputed proposition, then presumably that would be reviewable, and a district court finding on it would be reviewable under the clearly erroneous
and there's never
standard. But if, if the record in fact makes clear that the basic facts were public in 2000, then it seems to me it would be clearly erroneous to say that the your information was presented earlier than that.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, does a reading of this particular report does not reflect any of the concerns in the complaint. It's like saying this report had to do with D.C. General, so if it's 2000,
you can't... It had to do with mingling of funds between the district and D.C. General. That's what it had to do with.
But it's completely different allegations.
Because it invokes the Anti-Deficiency Act.
And it doesn't talk about the problem that was brought to light by this gentleman.
With?
If there was fraud, the GAO, as Congress's representative, would have brought that to the attention of D.C. If there were violations of the False Claims Act, they would have brought it to the attention of D.C. and most likely the Department of Justice. That's not here.
Your inference of false claims is derived from the same facts, is it not?
It says, did the PBC violate the anti-deficiency in...
I understand, yes.
Okay. By obligating more than...
Absolutely willy-nilly commingling of funds, right? But your inference of the filing of false claims is based on that core fact, right?
In part. But this report has nothing to do... The entity changed in 1999, okay? And that's what, you know, that's what he was reporting on.
I'm sorry, what changed in 99?
The entity, the way the hospital was used as an entity changed at that time. Maybe what we need to, maybe this is something we can put in if you require, in the additional briefing. But the other thing I'd like to point out is, you know, the appellee would like to have it both ways. I mean, first of all, the appellee says all these letters to HHS and DOJ were brought to the attention of the public, okay? And then she says, but we didn't know about them.
Are the letters in here?
The letters are not in there. They are not in
there. So everything, the only thing to rely on then is the statement at page 14.
And yes,
14.
And the first 15 pages were the discussion. All right, but I'd be more than willing to, if the court needs it, to have Mr. McCabe, you know, say what he knew.
Mr. McCabe?
The Department of Justice attorney, who's been copied, as you noted, on every pleading in this entire case and was supposed to be part of the teleconference call.
Are there further questions? No? I believe so. Thank you, Mr. Volzer.
You're welcome.
Mr. Anderson, thank you. Case is submitted.
Yeah.